Hello and welcome to the Haaretz podcast. I'm Allison Kaplan-Summer in Tel Aviv. Tony Kushner is a leading playwright and screenwriter who has been nominated for Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony Awards and received the National Medal of Arts from President Barack Obama in 2013. In recent years, he's become best known for his collaborations with director Steven Spielberg, but he will always be best identified with his theater masterpiece, Angels in America, the two-part epic play about the AIDS crisis and the Reagan era. Kushner was also one of the first prominent American Jews to speak out loudly and provocatively against Israeli government policy and the Jewish state's treatment of Palestinians. His views have, on occasion, cost him various honors and awards. Kushner continues to speak out over the course of the Israel-Gaza war, which is taking place just as a major production of Angels in America is playing at the Camery Theater in Tel Aviv. I spoke to Kushner about his views on the war, artists criticizing Israel on public platforms, like the recent Oscars ceremony, anti-Semitism in America, and his work with Spielberg. Our conversation coming up. Tony Kushner, thank you so much for coming on the Haaretz podcast.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So it's been 5 months now, if you can believe it, since the horrific attacks of October 7th, the war in Gaza. So that's just going to make me start with an open-ended question. As a Jew, as an artist, as a longtime activist on the question of Israel and Palestine, how has your experience been since October 7th, and how has it maybe changed and evolved as the months have passed?
Well, it's been a really terrible time, obviously, for everyone. I mean, mostly for people who have lost their lives or people who have been kidnapped, for the Palestinians who are suffering, unspeakably in Gaza. I've been to Gaza City. Every time there's any kind of bombardment of Gaza, I brace myself because I know that there, given the population density there's no way that there can be any kind of military action taken by the IDF in Gaza that doesn't result in substantial civilian casualties. The attacks on October 7th were gutting. They were, we all watched and learned about them in absolute horror. There was a great deal of perplexity here in the United States about how this happened. It seemed like there had been warnings. It seemed like there had been people within the security forces in Israel who were warning that this was about to happen. So the fact that it occurred still seems baffling and strange that it was permitted to occur. The underlying cause of the attack is not so baffling. But of course, the taking of the hostages, the fate of the hostages, which is still for many of them unknown, is a terrible thing. And of course, Jews everywhere, with our history of persecution and suffering, have a particular relationship to the news of a mass killing of Jews anywhere. So all of that was, shattering. And then the attack on Gaza began and continues and continues and continues and continues. I guess in terms of how my feelings about this have evolved, my feelings have evolved as the death toll in Gaza grows to a kind of an unimaginable proportion. If you had asked me, even on October 7th, would Israel allow 30,000 people, many of them civilians, to be killed by the IDF, I would have said no. I mean, would Israel allow what the UN is warning of now, an imminent famine, first in northern Gaza and then eventually for the people in Rafah? It's, I would have said no. I think there's obviously for me, at any rate, it seems obvious that, that the occupation has been a moral catastrophe for Israel, that the treatment of Palestinian people has been a blight on Israel's reputation since the founding of the state. But I had stupidly believed that there were limits. and I have to say that that's what's involved. It's clear, you know, part of this I blame on the Netanyahu and his ministers, people who have clearly no problems whatsoever with mass slaughter, this sort of fundamentalist madness that for many years, one thing that Israel could be very proud of is its refusal of these kind of messianic zealots and their visions. And I think it's dreadful that the country has fallen into the hands of people like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, and you know, ultimately the greatest blame, I suppose, goes to Netanyahu, who brought them into government, because he will do anything, and we've known this for years now, decades, this man will do anything to ensure his own survival. There's blame now that goes all around. The results of the new poll, the Democratic Index, I think is what it's called, are really dismaying. I mean, it's gratifying to see that a majority of Israelis don't trust Netanyahu, and very disturbing to see that, that a majority of Israelis think that what the IDF is doing in Gaza is legitimate. That brings me close to a feeling of despair.
Well, on a more upbeat note, one of the reasons that I was moved to want to interview you right now was the fact that there is an incredible production of your two-part theatrical masterpiece, Angels in America, playing at the Camery Theater in Tel Aviv. Part one has been running for a year, and part two recently premiered. And it's really indisputably the theatrical event of the season, actually two seasons in Tel Aviv, since they've spread it over two seasons. So I just wondered how that timing felt to you. Actually, you know, the Camry is right next to Hostage Square. So you walk out of the theater and it's all there right in front of you. And so you start thinking about life versus art. I wondered how that squared with you, because you're a co-founder and a member of the advisory board of Jewish Voice for Peace, and that's so identified with anti-Zionism, strong criticism in Israel, and even sympathy for the BDS movement. So how do you feel about the fact that your, you know, most personal artistic work, the one that's most identified with you, is being staged in Israel as this war is happening in Gaza? I'm curious if you feel conflicted and what you think of this wider issue of the intersection of art and politics and war.
There's a perception that I founded, was one of the founders of Jewish Voice for Peace. I wouldn't be ashamed if I was one of its founders, but I wasn't. I was asked fairly early on, I guess, in the organization's existence by friends to join its board of advisors, and I believe I'm still on its board of advisors. I have differences with Jewish Voice for Peace. I have never called myself an anti-Zionist or a Zionist, and I don't think this is just being rhetorically tricky and semantic. I call myself, I'm a Jewish American. And if I needed an adjective to go with Jewish apart from American, I would say I'm a diasporan Jew. Jewish roots are Jewish cultural roots certainly are deep in the diasporan Jewish community experience and history. I have said this many, many times. I don't believe in nation states as the solutions to the problems that all minorities face in every place where they find themselves. I think that it's hard to be a minority within a society of people that are different from you. And there are many political and legal and sometimes life and death issues that confront members of any kind of ethnic, religious, sexual preferential, you know, minority anywhere on earth. I have said sort of jokingly and not jokingly that the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution is my Jerusalem. That's my Zion. I think that the solution has to be in terms found within constitutional democracy, within the rule of law, within the precepts of multiculturalism the liberal democratic state, that minorities are protected from majoritarian tyranny and so on. It has certainly worked very well for Jews in America, which is not to say there isn't a threat of anti-Semitism here. There's a threat of anti-Semitism where there are Jews. And I believe that there is a particular character to anti-Semitism that is, you know, it's a profoundly complicated historical phenomenon. But I don't think it's exactly like, I mean, probably all forms of prejudice and bigotry and hatred are differentiable. Anti-Semitism is very long, or at least hatred of Jews, fear of Jews is an old, old, old thing. And there's wonderful books written about by people trying to figure out why it is that this thing exists and why it's so hard to get rid of it. That said, the Establishment Clause of the U.S. Constitution, separation of church and state, the idea of a secular state, the Equal Protection Under the Law Clause of the 14th Amendment, these things have really protected Jews in the United States and given us a chance to flourish. And I don't think I'm just being sort of short-sighted and parishional. I think that this is probably the closest to a solution that minorities can find. And I understand why Zionism emerged. I have had many arguments with a lot of people in the United States, friends of mine on the left. I really reject the equation of Zionism with colonialism and Zionism with racism. I think that it's simplistic, and I think that it ignores the true sources of Zionism and flattens large swaths of history in a way that I'm not at all comfortable with. I have never condemned the BDS movement. And honestly, one thing I could have added to your question about my evolution in the last 5 months is I've moved closer to the idea that maybe a boycott is necessary. But I can't do it. I don't want to do it. I can't separate myself from Israel in that way. It doesn't feel right. The people at JVP have never asked me to leave or attacked me for my views. They've asked me to stay as part of their community. And so since I like a lot of what they're doing, I have stayed with them.
So I think what's horrifying a lot of liberal Jews in America, actually, my previous guest on the podcast was Franklin Foer, who wrote this cover story in The Atlantic, The End of the Golden Age of American Jewry. And a lot of the values you mentioned and the Constitution that, you know, are supposed to be basic American values that protect American Jews and that a lot of American Jews have actually contributed to the development of. I mean, his argument goes that those values are breaking down in American society. And so therefore, as a parallel, anti-Semitism is rising and this golden age is over. But what's scaring a lot of liberal Jews is in America is, I guess, these kind of blurry lines that they used to think that anti-Semitism was primarily, if not completely, on the right. And what they see happening on the left, I guess, is a more extreme form of dialogue and a more, I don't, you know, want to say eliminationism of Israel. But yeah, more anti-Zionism and more that anything that is tainted by Israeliness needs to be rejected, including the local synagogue, including the local JCC, including, you know, which blurs that line between anti-Zionism or opposition to Israeli policy and anti-Semitism.
It's hard for me to be critical of people on the left because I am a person of the left. But I think there's everything ranging from people who would say that they want to see the state of Israel to cease to exist to a lot of people. And I would say that this is, my guess is that this is the majority of people on the left who, you know, really believe that the slogan "Palestine will be free from the river to the sea" is simply a statement that the Palestinian people deserve justice and statehood and redress for the terrible wrongs that have been done them. That slogan is not just that. And there's a lot of naivety on the part of the left, I believe, much more of that than there is of anti-Semitism. I read a lot of news, almost always the accounts of sort of pro-Palestinian demonstrators assaulting, you know, Jews and assaulting synagogues and pro-Palestinian students assaulting Jewish students and so on. These stories sort of flare up and then break down pretty quickly. And I'm, you know, there's been a concerted attempt by right-wing American Jews to sort of sell the idea that American college campuses, for instance, are awash with, you know, virulent anti-Semites, professors and students and so on. And the Jewish students are walking these campuses in terror for their lives. I think this is nonsense. I see no evidence of it. I've been waiting for evidence of it. In article after article, even in places like the New York Times, you sort of see the headline that sort of suggests that what you're going to get finally is like some kind of statistical accounting of how many instances of assaults on Jewish students there have been, and so on and so forth. I haven't seen it. If it's there, maybe I have missed it, but I haven't seen it anywhere. And I really, knowing the people that I know who are passionately involved in calls for a ceasefire, these are not people who are anti-Semites. Their interest is not in destroying Israel, and I think their interest is not in pogroms against Jews elsewhere. What they're really interested in, and the passion and the rage that you're seeing, is because thousands of lives are at stake, tens of thousands, millions of lives are at stake, and because before our eyes, what really looks a lot like ethnic cleansing to me is going on. I mean, I tend to believe the people on the extreme right in Netanyahu's cabinet who say, "Yeah, it's ours now." How is that not ethnic cleansing? And I think that's gotten a lot of people very, very angry. But I don't think that anger means that these people are out to destroy Israel. And you know, a two-state solution, even if there was good faith and the political will of the entire planet to create that, given the history, would be enormously difficult. And given the situation of Israel, would be enormously difficult. And that very much concerns me. I do not want Israel destroyed. I want Israelis to be able to live in peace and security. I believe that the treatment of the Palestinians, as many Israelis have been saying for decades, that the occupation of the West Bank and the imprisonment of people in Gaza and the checkpoints and the wall and all this stuff actually doesn't make Israel safe. I want Israel to be safe. I think that to negotiate all these things, to figure out a way to make Israel a viable geopolitical entity with a Palestinian state, is a very complicated and difficult thing. I believe it's possible, because I believe ultimately there is no real distinction at this point between the desires of the Palestinian people and the desires of the Israeli people, which are fundamentally to live at peace.
Probably the best transition between all of these current events and your work, which really should be, you know, noted in this interview, is that recently the New York Times, not so recently, a few months ago, said that the best movie about Israel and Gaza came out 18 years ago. And they were talking about your first collaboration with Steven Spielberg, the movie Munich. And indeed, I was thinking about it when, you know, we were talking about October 7th and the issue of trying to keep your people safe versus what looks like retribution. Munich, people talk about the Yom Kippur War being, you know, the shocking surprise that they compare October 7th to, but Munich was a shock too. And I think, you know, that same sort of like hitting at the pride of Israel, which really thought it was able to keep their civilians safe, and in Munich they weren't, and also on October 7th they weren't. And you wrote some pretty profound dialogue between Israelis and Palestinian terrorists about the patience of waiting out. The Israeli character in Munich said, "You killed Jews and the world feels bad for them and thinks you are animals." And then the Palestinian terrorist responds, "Yes, but then the world will see how they've made us into animals." I mean, that all, looking back, feels a little bit prophetic and accounts for the inability of the world to, you know, distinguish between the Palestinian cause at large and the violent ideology of a group like Hamas.
I'm very proud of Munich, the film. We got a lot of flack for it when it was first released, and also a lot of support, which is, I think, an interesting thing. It's you know, I believe that truth ages better than lies, always, and that lies are always exposed by, I believe that truth is the daughter of time. One thing that I've been thinking in the last few months in terms of Munich is that even then, there was this kind of assumption when the first people started speaking out against Munich that that of course the entire sort of Jewish community in the United States and in Israel, where I think the film was greeted with a good deal of hostility at first, that there was a sort of a monolithic rejection because of this presumed monolithic lockstep defense of everything that Israel does. And, you know, the idea that one could criticize Israel's targeted assassination program after the Munich massacre, I mean, Netanyahu, unbelievably, was, I think, prime minister then and was grousing about this then, that, you know, you're not allowed to criticize Israel. To criticize Israel is to betray Israel, as our disgraced former president just said again. In an interview, that the loyalty means, you know, complete silence and submission, subjugation of your moral faculties and your ability to speak. But the truth is that there has never been, you know, I mean, Jews don't ever fall into lockstep like that, or mostly we don't. We're contentious people, and people that believe in argument. It's not contentiousness because we're, you know, bad tempered. It's contentiousness because we know that the only way to understand the truth, which is very, very tricky and complicated at all times, is to argue about it. Munich was intended to be at least an argument, a way of bringing the argument into, you know, and Stephen showed great courage in the man who made Schindler's List and created the Shoah Project and so on, and in following his principles, his belief in the rule of law and in due process. Ask very important questions about targeted assassination and retaliation and so on. Stephen and I watched the movie together recently, about a year ago, because we hadn't seen it in a long time, either of us. And what I was stunned by in watching Munich, and I give Stephen complete credit for this, is a very bloody movie. There are a lot of people who die in it. And he never said that he was doing this, you know, intentionally, but one of the really great things, maybe the greatest thing I think about that movie, is this thing that he did. There isn't a single person that dies on camera, on the screen, who's dehumanized before they're killed. Every single person that dies, even in the scene in Beirut where there are a lot of people dying, when you see somebody shot and killed, Stephen includes some little moment right before their death, often a very powerful moment, that makes you cringe, wince when they're killed. It's that refusal of dehumanization that I think is the most profound gesture in Munich, and you can watch the movie. You don't take my word for it. Watch the movie; it's really true. I mean, that's why I think Stephen is a very great artist, because I think he's not able to dehumanize. I saw this process when we were filming Munich, and the Palestinian actors who were in the movie, both the guys that were playing the people, the murderers in Munich, and the people who were playing the targets of the Israeli assassins, they all wanted to talk to Stephen, and they wanted to talk to Stephen about being Palestinian and about what life is like for Palestinians, about Palestinian history. And Stephen engage with them, happily and eagerly. And I think they had a profound effect on the movie in that way. And I've seen him do this. I've made four movies with him now, and he does this every time. I mean, he there's an openness in him and a real decency and a refusal to see any other human being as not quite the same as him, as somehow lesser than him, as somehow less deserving of life than he is. And I think it's in every film that he makes. And it's one of the reasons that I love him as a person, and also that I revere him as an artist.
I think a lot of people would pay good money to see you and Spielberg discuss the current Israel-Gaza war. You spoke out about it immediately. He stayed quiet until like December, and then he finally said something about it. But you are such, looks like, close creative partners and friends, and yet your image, you know, in the wider Jewish community, he's sort of like the darling, and you're a little bit of the bad boy, right? But it seems that you work together.
I mean, I don't think I'm bad. I
didn't say you were bad. I was talking about a bad boy image.
That's funny, because I think of myself as being so, and I'm sure that there are a lot of people who would say, oh my God, he's such a compromised, you know, sellout type person.
When it comes to criticizing Israel, you were out there in 2004. I actually looked up an interview done with you when your book, Wrestling with Zion, came out in 2004.
Oh, yeah.
And I was thinking that all you had to do is...
Long before that.
I thought all you had to do is switch the names Ariel Sharon and Benjamin Netanyahu, and pretty much all of your statements look very similar to what you're saying today.
Yeah. I mean, it's... although weirdly Ariel Sharon remains the only one who's dismantled the settlement.
Yeah.
So, you know, go figure. I mean, he was a hideous human being, but you know, again, it's like the one thing, you know, there's been a lot of terrible stuff in the United States. The 92nd Street Y, which is the YMHC, the Young Men's Hebrew Association, the 92nd Street Y, which is I don't know whether it's known in Israel. I'm sure it must be.
Mm-hmm, very
it's
much
like
so.
It's a cultural institution of immense significance to the intellectual and artistic life of New York City, and I would say of the United States. And tragically, and the heart of the Y and its vitality was the Poetry Center. And tragically, because the board of the Y made this appalling decision to cancel an event after October 7th with Viet Thanh Nguyen, because he had once signed a petition supporting BDS or something, they postponed it. They didn't cancel it, but they postponed it, meaning they canceled it. And as a result of which, of the protests over this, they basically canceled the entire Poetry Center. I'm sure they're going to revive it in some way, but it won't mean what it meant, because a lot of people, me included, will never certainly not want to go there anytime soon. The idea that, you know, in the blowback after Jonathan Glazer's, you know, really sort of unimpeachable, irrefutable statement at the Oscars.
You identified with what he said?
Of course. I mean, who doesn't? What he's saying is so simple. He's saying Jewishness, Jewish identity, Jewish history, the history of the Holocaust, the history of Jewish suffering must not be used in a campaign as an excuse for a project of dehumanizing or slaughtering other people. This is a misappropriation of what it means to be a Jew, what the Holocaust meant. And he rejects that. Who doesn't agree with that? What kind of person thinks that what's going on now in Gaza is acceptable? And if you find yourself saying out loud and in public, oh, it's fine with me what they're doing, because you feel that it's the only choice for you because you're a Jew, is to defend everything that Israel does, shame on you. Read Haaretz. I mean, I say that jokingly, but...
No, you can say it. You can say it seriously. It's fine.
Well, I said it a while ago when the Jerusalem Post, you know, ran something about how people who are upset about what's happening in Gaza aren't Jews anymore or something. And I said, I think some, I forget who it was, some interviewer asked me about it. And I said, why are you, my response is, don't read the Jerusalem Post, read Haaretz. And I really think that most Jewish Americans, I mean, I'm not, you know, blowing hot air in your direction, most Jewish Americans would be genuinely shocked at what runs every day in Haaretz, just as if they went to Israel and talked to Israelis, they would be genuinely shocked. I mean, things that Israelis say that are critical of their own government are things that could get, you know, a rabbi fired at a fairly liberal, you know, New York synagogue. I mean, it's you know, this idea that complete surrender and complicity to any Israeli prime minister, no matter who it is, no matter how reactionary or disastrous he is, that he has to be sort of like embraced, and that his cabinet or her cabinet has to be, you know, embraced, or that any policy has to be endorsed, is madness. And it's, you know, certainly not ever true of Israel. You know, I think there are people who were shocked to see the demonstrations last summer about the judicial bills in this country, sort of surprised that they thought all Israelis sort of, you know, took out little Israeli flags and marched, you know, in lockstep down the street to whatever song Netanyahu was playing. You know, there is no country on earth that will prosper or survive as a habitable, desirable place if its citizenry stops criticizing it.
Speaking of the country that you are a citizen of, transitioning from Israeli politics, which is problematic, to American politics, which you might think is problematic as well. I'm curious, as a Jew and as a gay man, I would presume that you are more than a little anxious about the prospect of another Donald Trump presidency. Donald Trump, it appears, is going to be the Republican nominee, pretty much a fact.
Yeah,
how concerned are you? How worried are you about Biden versus Trump in the upcoming campaign?
I believe that we are going to win. I really genuinely believe that we are going to win. And I think we have to work very, very hard and not be complacent about that, because I think that, you know, it breaks my heart to say this, but I think that the MAGA movement and the Republican Party have become the most successful fascist movement, anti-democratic movement in the history of the United States. Arguably, you know, well, I won't go there. But I mean, it's you know, these people are quite seriously, you know, openly fascist. They call themselves, you know, parliamentary fascists after their, you know, poster boy, Viktor Orban, but they're fascists. They don't like democracy. In fact, they despise it. And they sort of come out about that. So I think we are facing a moment of severe existential crisis. I mean, you know, as is Israel, as is pretty much, you know, every country in Europe that has an active fascist movement, whether their government has fallen into the hands of the promoters of fascism, of anti-democratic legislation and executive order, as America was for 4 years under Donald Trump, and as Israel currently is under Netanyahu and his current cabinet. As the judicial reform, you know, judicial reforms as his attempt to, you know, consolidate all power within his position indicates. So, you know, we're all in this. This is it's an interesting thing that this crisis of the idea of democracy. I mean, when I worked with Stephen on Lincoln, I mean, I spent years reading about, you know, the way in which the fundamental, you know, what Lincoln says in the Gettysburg Address, that our fathers put forth on this continent a new nation dedicated, you know, to an idea, to test an idea. And the idea that they were testing is whether or not democracy could work, a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And it's hard. Democracy is hard. And people get tired of it and worn down by it. And the American people have learned a lot after 270 years of the democratic experiment. And I don't think that we're going to surrender it to this monster.
Well, you know, it was, I'm sure I'm not the first, but it was hard to watch Angels in America and listen to the Roy Cohn monologues without thinking, yeah, that was Donald Trump's mentor. When you wrote those lines, when you wrote, you know, let nothing stand in your way and nobody escape, save yourself, did you ever think that like the leader of the free world would be, have learned at the knee of that person?
You know, he didn't. I mean, Roy Cohn was an important figure in Trump's life, and Roy certainly taught him. There's a great quote from Herman Melville. It's from his book, his novella, Billy Budd, about Claggart, the villain in Billy Budd. And he says, Melville says of him, he had perfected the ambidextre use of the rational as an ambidextre instrument for effecting the irrational. And I had that sort of pinned over my desk when I was working on Angels in America. I believe, however, that Roy actually believed certain things. I think he was genuinely opposed to communism and was willing to do anything, including murder somebody, which I think he was guilty of with Ethel Rosenberg, to do it. But I think that there was something coherent at the core of Roy Cohn. I could be wrong, but he was capable of loyalty. Even though it was very unfashionable, he stayed true to the memory of Joe McCarthy all his life. And what we have learned now, and what I can't believe that the people surrounding Donald Trump don't understand, including his children, is Donald Trump has loyalty for no one. There is nothing in there but his own severely damaged self-reflection. And I mean, that's the genuinely terrifying thing about him. About people like him. I think Netanyahu is drinking from very much the same pathological well. There is no other person there. There is no other being. There isn't even the concept that there are other beings. And so loyalty is an impossibility. And, you know, Trump dropped Roy like a hot potato when he got AIDS. He welched on promises that he made to Roy to help out friends of Roy's who were sick. I'm not saying that Roy was anything other than a villain. He was a terrible person. But he wasn't. There was something coherent there, whereas I think Trump is a very different thing. So, yeah, you know, I mean, what I think Angels will tell you if you listen to that political stuff in the play is that the Republicans have been working on this for a very long time. It makes me very angry to hear, you know, sort of never Trumper type Republicans talking now and saying, you know, they can't understand what happened to their party. There is nothing more profoundly anti-democratic than saying that government is bad, because the manifestation of the demos in a democracy is government. That's how the people exist in the government is of the people. So if you are anti-government, you are anti-people, you are anti-democracy. And the Republican Party's message for a very long time, but really it picked up, it sort of cohered around Ronald Reagan. And Roy was part of all of this stuff. You know, these people were fools. They made what I call the Hitler mistake. They didn't believe that if they pushed government farther and farther away from its natural home as the expression, the genuine expression of the needs and desires and dreams of its people, and closer to being just an instrument for effecting the irrational, for consolidating power, people, stupid people in history always say, well, we'll control him. There are Israelis and American billionaires who, you know, who say, oh sure, let Smotrich into, you know, let Ben-Gvir, we'll control him. We know he's a nut, but, you know, and a dangerous person, but we'll control him. Somebody will, you know, we won't let him, we have the real power and we'll pull the leash if he gets too crazy. And then, of course, suddenly you've got, you know, a maniac at the seat of power, and oops, turns out you can't control them. So, and it's the Hitler mistake. We make it over and over again. And these morons in Wall Street who are shoveling money at Trump because they think, oh, this is great. He'll cut our taxes again and we'll control him. No, you won't. You let somebody like this get control and he won't last long because fascists never last long, but he'll do unspeakable damage. He already did it during his first 4 years, and much worse is to come.
We've talked about Israeli politics. We've talked about American politics. I would like to close off. We could keep talking forever, but I would like to just hear maybe some thoughts on American Jewish identity. Again, I just saw Angels in America in Israel, and it was so interesting as an American Jew living in Israel to sit in a theater and watch an Israeli actor perform the prologue, the rabbi's eulogy over a grave, which is all about Jewish identity, the old world and the new world. And I was thinking about how it's so different in the two countries, what it meant to move this shtetl identity to America in contrast to what it meant to move to the Middle East, and also in terms of your work with Spielberg, leaving Munich aside for a moment, I'm thinking about Lincoln and West Side Story, and most obviously, The Fablemans. I don't know if we're just projecting because of who the two of you are, but everything seems to be some sort of different take or angle on being Jewish, being an American, what those two things mean, and what the intersection of those two things mean. Am I wrong to see so many of those themes in your work?
No, not at all. I mean, I'm a gay Jewish American, and those three component parts of my identity are, I mean, I don't want to fetishize my identity. I've also written, plays about Black people and plays about Afghans, I believe that the role of the artist is to reach out beyond one's boundaries and to show the world what one person imagining another person is like at any given time. Any artist brings themselves to the table, to the workbench, to the easel or the desk, and I think I see the world in a very Jewish way. I think I certainly refer to Jewish thinkers, to Jewish scholars, to Jewish history, to the holy scriptures, to Jewish poets and artists, not exclusively at all, but often, and I feel that in my intimate familiarity with the kind of Jew that I am, and this is true of any human being on the planet, if you dig deep within yourself, I believe there are universals that you can discover, things that are of meaning and of value to other human beings, whoever they are. So I dig in my Jewish self. Constantly, and I remain convinced that the truth is in there somewhere, and that's my job is to try and figure it out and to keep talking. I mean, I think that this is what we used to say in the old days of the AIDS epidemic: silence equals death, and it really does. The most important thing in these crises is to keep talking. I mean, I don't know exactly what's going on in Qatar or in Cairo right now, but keep talking. There are diplomatic solutions to these things. There are no military solutions that would make any sense right now, but there are diplomatic solutions, and we have to believe that. We have talked ourselves as a species to into astonishing places as well as into very bad places, but I think an ongoing dialogue and discussion and a refusal to surrender the peace process, I absolutely believe will lead to peace. And bombing and starving is will lead nowhere good. And will lead to more Holocausts and to more destruction and unimaginable horror. So let's keep talking.
Well, in the spirit of talking, I want to thank you for talking to us. I really, really appreciate you coming on the podcast.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk to you. I enjoyed this.
And we thank you even more for reading Haaretz every day.
Well, it's a remarkable newspaper. It really is. And I'm grateful to it because I've learned a lot.
Again, Tony Kushner, thanks so much. And that wraps things up for the Haaretz podcast. Many, many thanks to my guest, Tony Kushner. And thank you to my producer, Avi Rosenzvi, and editor, Nara Malkin. I'm Allison Kaplan-Summer, and until next week, shalom from Tel Aviv.